Catskill. From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Well, coming up, we're going to go to the fair, at least a little bit, via the radio. We've got a report from the New York Public News Network about the Great New York State Fair, which started today in Syracuse. And we'll also talk to Kimberly Izar about her experience as a first-time attendee of the Little World's Fair in Grahamsville, New York, and get a little preview of her reporting that will debut on Farm and Country on Saturday. We learn about a special screening of rare archival footage of the Talking Heads that's coming up in the community. Genevieve Hartnett has that report. All of that in the second half of the program. But we're going to start tonight with a story about child care and the increasing demand for it in New York State. As of early July, 21 counties, including Sullivan and Delaware right here in our listening area, have paused new enrollment in the Child Care Assistance Program. That's the state's biggest voucher initiative for working families. Families that are looking for child care assistance are being put on wait lists, even amid promises of extra funding. Julia Rock reports for New York Focus. Her latest article dives deep on this current situation, why it's happening, and how it's impacting the state. I spoke to her earlier this afternoon. Well, Julia Rock, welcome back to the local edition.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
So why are so many counties like Sullivan and Delaware County here in our listening area, why are they closing applications for child care help?
A long story short is that there is a funding shortfall for the program that the state made an effort to address during budget talks this spring, but doesn't seem to have been fully resolved. And as you know, this is a voucher program for parents with young children to help them pay for the cost of childcare, which is, anyone with a child knows, very high in New York. These vouchers cover almost the entire cost of private daycare, and the state has expanded eligibility for the vouchers in recent years so that parents earning a little bit more money can receive them. But with the increased demand that has come with that eligibility expansion, the state has not really kept up adequate funding levels. And that sort of all came to a head this spring during state budget talks. And now there are 21 counties around the state that have closed applications for the program.
Wow. So is it really just down to a funding issue, or are there other factors? I mean, a funding issue, meaning the funds, even though New York State's been adding funds, have not been adequate to meet the demand. So is it really just like a skyrocketing demand and not being funded enough? Are there any other factors at play here to bring it to where it's at right now?
I mean, more or less, it really is a funding issue. There are some specific things that have happened that have, you know, shaped the way this has played out. The state allocates the money to counties based on how many kids are currently getting the vouchers and other factors. And so there are other parts of the state, namely New York City, where demand increased even more sharply. And what happened in New York City this spring was the city government was going to reinstitute work requirements for cash assistance, and that was expected to sort of further increase demand for the program. So when something like that, you know, happens in a city with 8 million people, obviously it affects the entire program. But more or less, the story really just has been, you know, the state has wanted to grow this program. It has been very successful in growing it. But as more people have learned about it, more people have become eligible, you know, the state has just not kept up a funding expansion to meet that.
Just along those lines, is the current administration in Washington, D.C. pursuing cuts at all levels? Is that reality of funding impacting this either directly or indirectly?
Well, so in terms of direct effects, this is a program that is partially funded by the federal government. And, you know, the feds have at least so far not cut funding for the program, although there also has not been an increase, even though, you know, the cost of childcare is skyrocketing around the country. I think we can see some indirect effects, although they can be hard to parse. I mean, one thing is that, you know, counties around the state are anticipating cuts to funding for SNAP and Medicaid. Those are programs that are administered, obviously, in part by the counties in New York. And so I think as they're anticipating, you know, the federal money coming in being lower, it might lead them to be a little bit more conservative in doling out money for things like child care assistance. You know, they're in this environment of cuts and funding shortfalls. And so they might be sort of more conservative in how they're spending the money on child care assistance, which might lead them to put up a wait list more quickly. That is not something that county officials have told me they're doing, but that is something that, you know, advocates have said to me they anticipate might be happening.
So there's a lot of people on these wait lists. As you mentioned, there's 21 counties in the state that are no longer even accepting applications. What does it mean for a family when they get put on a wait list? What happens?
Yeah, so some counties actually don't operate wait lists. They just say, we're not accepting new applications right now. We'll let you know when we are. Other counties have, at least two counties, I think, are operating wait lists. So, you know, they'll call you when a spot opens up. I mean, if I were a parent, I would certainly, you know, call the county or call my local social service district and ask them when they anticipate applications are going to be reopened, whether or not there's a wait list. But at this point, I think it's, if you don't have access to the program, you know, that's going to be the case until the county starts enrolling people again. The state budget this spring did allocate some additional funds for the program that I think the state really hopes means counties are going to be able to start accepting people again. But there are some restrictions on those funds that have meant counties aren't sure whether they're going to be able to access them, or they don't want to, you know, do what would be required to get the money, namely spend all of the money they currently have. You know, if I were a parent or someone living in one of these counties, I'd also really be curious to know what the status of that state money was.
In the article, you mentioned that there's more than 1,500 families in New York City alone on the wait list. How do you compare, if at all, what's happening in, you know, places like New York City with what's happening in more rural areas and smaller counties upstate?
Yeah, certainly the story is sort of similar everywhere in that, you know, there's more demand for the program than counties can meet at this point in time. One other factor that has contributed to the funding shortfall that I didn't mention before is, you know, as the cost of childcare is going up for parents, it's of course going up for the state too. You know, these vouchers, the amount that these vouchers would cover increased this year. The state has to, you know, readjust each year based on what the market rate for daycare is. So also, you know, of course, rising childcare costs are contributing to the cost of this program.
Did you talk to any parents that are being impacted about this? What are families on the ground saying?
Yeah, I've spoken with a lot of parents who are impacted by this. And these funding shortfalls in particular are affecting the parents who, you know, earn a little bit more money and were affected by the eligibility expansion. They're still being, you know, crushed by the cost of rent, the cost of childcare. And what a lot of people said to me is that, you know, if they can't get these vouchers or when they lose these vouchers, it means they can't afford, you know, to keep their jobs or they have to cut spending on other things like food for their kids. Or, you know, they're going to have to rely more on family members or neighbors or more informal arrangements to get childcare, which obviously can be a really hard thing to cobble together if you're working, you know, full time 5 days a week. So this is really something that's affecting, you know, parents who are working. And, you know, if this is not something that the state invests a lot more money into, I think we're going to keep seeing counties closing applications.
I'm Jason Dole. This is the Local Edition. I'm talking to Julia Rock, whose most recent article for New York Focus is called 21 Counties Have Closed Applications for New York's Biggest Child Care Affordability Program. Julia, I'm wondering, I just asked you about, you know, parents and families. How are they dealing with this? What about the people who provide child care services? What are providers saying about this moment? How are they dealing with this?
Well, it's a big challenge. challenge for providers because they really need to keep sort of a consistent number of, you know, kids coming in to keep their budget steady. And, you know, some providers, the vast majority of kids in their programs are paying for it through these child care vouchers. So I think it really creates a lot of uncertainty. You know, it can make it hard for providers to keep their doors open. Child care providers operate on really thin margins. So, you know, a big impact, like a bunch of parents who aren't going to be able to afford, you know, keep coming to your child care program, or parents who used to be able to afford it because they had the voucher and no longer have access to it, that can really be a big problem.
What about other folks, other players in here, lawmakers, advocates, what are they saying?
I think the big demand right now from legislators and advocates is for the state to release the funds that were allocated during the budget this spring as quickly as possible, and to make it so that as many counties as possible that need the money can access it. I think there's been some frustration with the way the state has structured the requirements on those funds and its plan for getting them out the door. And I, you know, my understanding from the advocacy world and from some of the legislators who work on childcare is that they'd like to see this money go out the door sort of as quickly and efficiently as possible.
And looking ahead on this story, like what are you going to be watching for, and what changes do you think will or could or should happen in regards to this program, at least in terms of, you know, making sure that this it becomes more fair and stable for families across New York? What are you going to be watching for?
Well, I'll certainly be watching to see how the state proceeds in deciding how it's going to distribute these additional funds and whether that allows counties to reopen applications and start enrolling new parents again. Funding for this program was a big fight during this year's budget season, and I expect it's going to be a big fight again next year. The state has framed these additional funds as a one-year investment, but it's sort of hard to see if the state wants to, you know, continue this expanded eligibility for the program and continue to help parents with childcare costs. It's hard to see how the state is going to sort of reduce funding for it next year. Of course, that's going to be happening, you know, during a state budget fight when there are big holes in the budget due to cuts at the federal level. So very up in the air how things move forward with this program. But the governor has made it sort of a priority of hers. I think she sees it as a big victory that enrollment has increased a lot in the program. While she's been governor, she's increased funding for it. So I think we can expect a big budget fight next year.
Big budget fight. You know, you end the article with a quote from Pete Nabosny, who's a policy director at Rochester-based advocacy organization called the Children's Agenda. And basically he says, quote, "We will have another bite at the apple with the state budget next year, but it's going to be coming in a pretty challenging budget year," end quote from Pete Nabosny, an advocate there. So, I mean, that's basically, and that brings us back to what we were talking about earlier is, you know, New York's struggling to keep this funding, and now New York's going to be struggling with even more because of the federal cuts. That's going to greatly affect the tone and the shape of that budget fight next year.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable that, you know, different programs are going to be jockeying as the state decides sort of how it's going to move forward in this federal budget environment. So we will see, you know, how big of a priority childcare affordability is for New York State.
All right. Well, Julia Rock is reporter for New York Focus, and she's been talking to us about this deep look into the struggle of New York to fund childcare. Julia, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And again, that article is up now at nysfocus.com.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. If you know anything about punk rock and new wave music of the late 70s into the early 80s, you probably have heard of CBGB in the East Village and the many bands that got their start performing there, including the Ramones, Blondie, the Talking Heads, Television. If you've never heard of the club, you'll have the chance to experience it on video As the common good in Ellenville is showing, never-before-seen footage of the Talking Heads performing at CBGB in 1975. It was captured on video by Metropolis Video. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett spoke with John Hazard of Metropolis Video. They talk about public access to music, the unique theatricality of the Talking Heads, and the importance of collaboration between burgeoning artists.
It was 1975 in the East Village in New York City. A group of young filmmakers, who called themselves Metropolis Video, were cutting their teeth shooting punk rock and new wave bands at the CBGB nightclub. And one of them was an NYU film student named John Hazard.
With a name like mine, you could say I know enough to be dangerous about a lot of things.
That was John. Using borrowed film equipment, John and Metropolis Video worked to bring the eclectic music scene of the village to all on public access television. It's safe to say we might have no record of the early work of Blondie or the Talking Heads without John and his team. And you may find yourself at the Common Good in Ellenville this Friday, August 22nd, where Hazard will be showing never-before-seen footage of two early performances of the Talking Heads filmed at CBGB in the 1970s.
The people I hooked up with, who were essentially were the Metropolis Video folks, I got brought in because of my camera skills. And I knew the woman who was a part of Metropolis Video. Her name's Pat Ivers. She's got a whole story herself. And so essentially, these people that I have remained connected to through all this video work were active as former students. They were really actually working and volunteering at Sterling Manhattan Cable TV. And they were the ones who were distributing and making available portable video equipment through the public access channel. That was the whole idea, is that anybody could walk in off the streets and use what was at that moment brand new portable video technology. And so that was what my friends in Metropolis were focused on. They were doing public access. And once they got down to CB's and saw what was happening, they thought, there's no live music. Why don't we do live music? And had a weekly television show on public access, Saturday night at midnight, live from CBGB. And we showed all the video that we were making in those days.
But Hazard notes that as soon as the Talking Heads came into CBGB and started working with Metropolis, his artistry and craft as a videographer was pushed to new heights.
You talked about how the Talking Heads, you worked specifically with them and they were really interested in public access of their music. Can you talk a little bit more about what their ideas were, what they worked with you on? What were they particularly passionate about in working with you?
More than any other of the bands that we filmed, Talking Heads wanted to see what we were doing, and they had input. So basically, when David Byrne saw the way that we had filmed the thing and were inspired by the music and were thinking of it experimental cinema ourselves, wanted to express the video in a way that mirrored the music that we were hearing, then that's what the first set that I'm going to show demonstrates. David actually said, well, I would prefer it if you treated us like a football game and don't do any of these kinds of dissolves and special shots. Just have straight frames of us playing. We came in for a second shoot and a third shoot. We figured out we could add some light. That moment, the next generation of portable video cameras suddenly appeared. So on the second shoot with the Talking Heads, we showed up with better cameras and better lighting. And we even mounted a full master shot camera from the ceiling. And, you know, what I find really interesting about that is to have seen them develop and seen David Byrne's career such that by the time you get to Stop Making Sense, which I just think of as the go-to live performance film, and you see the design element of that and the way that he builds that film working with Jonathan Demme, He's a consummate showman, and he thinks about theater, and he thinks about live music. And he was always able to carry that aesthetic forward.
The ways we shoot, produce, and consume music have changed drastically since John and Metropolis Video were working with artists in the Village in the mid-1970s. And while CBGB closed in 2006, Hazard hopes that this live footage reminds folks that developing artists of all types should be given the opportunity to grow.
CBGB's Embodied in the Moment was a place for musicians who couldn't get booked anywhere else, who had their own style of songs, who just had new material. They were not cover bands. And the owner decided to let them come and play. I mean, CBGB is something representing country bluegrass. But one of the musicians, as I read about it, persuaded the owner to start booking these independent groups that were just sort of around at that moment. The term punk rock hadn't been invented. It came along right in that era. And a magazine called Punk showed up. And there was just a sense, especially on the Lower East Side, that this was a pretty feral moment, but you could really experience something that was unique and matched the mood of the city.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Genevieve. And just a note, the Common Good in Ellenville is owned by Radio Catskill board member Matthew Goldman. And now it's time for fair news. The Great New York State Fair started today near Syracuse. And as Ellen Abbott with the New York Public News Network reports, fairgoers will find old favorites, but there's always something new to experience.
The first thing fair officials showed off during the annual media preview, a new take on an old food, cream puffs. Pastries sandwiched between fresh whipped cream, courtesy of New York State dairy farmers. Fair director Julie LaFave gives it high marks.
I thought I was just getting a bite of cream there, but look at all of that surprise underneath. All that pistachio crunch.
This is LaFave's second year heading up the yearly exposition. And one of the things she's trying to do, make sure all parts of the 375-acre fairgrounds are being utilized. And that starts with looking at a map of every inch of the fair.
Where has traffic slowed down for the past few years? And then we talk to our electricians, and we talk to our plumbers, and we look at the traffic patterns and fire lanes. And if it checks all those boxes, then we put stuff there.
For example, an empty grassy area in front of the administration building. This year, the Mobile Museum of Tolerance fills that spot, bringing what program director Lindsay Brill calls an important message in this day and age.
Take lessons from history in order to confront discrimination, anti-Semitism, bigotry, racism, just hate and discrimination in all its forms.
Officials are also trying to emphasize the roots of the fair, which started in 1841 as an agricultural exposition. That means an overhaul of the horticulture building to boost visibility of products made in New York. State Agriculture Commissioner Richard Ball says that starts with the centerpiece of it all, a new Taste of New York booth.
We've got over $100 million in sales since we started it. So this is becoming very popular with consumers and with our growers.
And in that booth, something you can't buy anywhere else but New York State, according to manager Christopher Ian, honeyberry jam.
I would say it's kind of a cross between blueberry and elderberry. Really nice.
Last year's attendance for the 13-day fair was just shy of 900,000. LaFave doesn't rule out hitting the 1 million mark this year, but admits maybe that's not the most important metric of a successful fair.
If you have a really, really high attendance number, is it as enjoyable as it could be? So the long answer and the short answer is we'd like to see a lot of people here, but we want them all to have a good time.
In Syracuse, I'm Ellen Abbott for the New York Public News Network.
And thank you to the New York Public News Network for that report. And speaking of farmers and the fair, we're going to stay on the fair right now and check in with our own reporter from Radio Catskill and host of Farm and Country, Kimberly Izar, joining me in the studio right now. Kimberly, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Good, good. So this past weekend was the Little World's Fair in Grahamsville, New York, and I know you were there. Are you preparing something for Farm and Country on Saturday.
Yes, I am. And Jason, it was actually my first Grahamsville Little World's Fair, and it was so much fun. I didn't know that the fair is actually the longest independent running fair in all of New York State, which is really cool. But you know, I grew up in an urban environment, and so seeing so many 4-H youth interact with animals and their environment was so much fun. Really, you know, there was tons of cattle, rabbits, horses, livestock shows, and you know, you'll hear this on Farm and Country, but there's also lots of different competitions. Like there's livestock shows, but then there's also like lumberjack shows. And you get a little bit of a sneak peek of that here on Local Edition, but you can, you know, listen to it on Saturday.
And the 4-H students also, you know, submit for contests and judging, as well as animals, produce that they grow. And also there's, I always like the crafts barn. There's the barn where they're working on crafts and stuff.
There is, and I actually spoke to one of the 4-H youth. Her name was Sloan, and she was showing me how they actually make soap using alpaca fiber, which I didn't, you know, truly understand until I spoke to Sloan, the differences between alpaca fiber and llama fiber, for example. They're two completely different types. And, you know, Sloan kind of walked me through. And she also showed me the alpaca that she showed in one of the shows, which was so fun. I will say that given the name of the Grahamsville Little World's Fair, I was expecting it to be quite small, but there was actually so much going on. There was like live music and so many different attractions and games for really everyone who I'm sure walked through that weekend.
See, I did grow up going to this fair. I think they probably took me to this fair like when I was an infant, and I don't even remember, but I have very early memories going there. So whenever I go there, it feels really small.
Well, now I have to ask you, I'm going to turn the question back to you. Like, what, comparing the two different types of fair, what is the kind of the difference for you?
It's hard for me to compare because, again, it's like going home. It's like you grew up there. So it's like, you know, I'm seeing things that you know, I was looking at, you know, 43 years ago. I'm like, oh, I remember sitting on this hill. I remember doing this. I remember going on these rides, you know, and then I just wander around going like, was it always this small or did I just get so much bigger?
Yeah, I will say, like, you know, as someone who moved to the county, you know, just this year, I was surprised by how many organizations like I was already familiar with when I got there. Like it really does feel like a slice of Sullivan County home there.
All right. So before we go tonight, listener, we're going to give you a little preview of what you'll be able to find on Farm and Country. And this is how your report on the fair is going to open up, right?
That's right.
All right. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Of course. Thanks, Jason. It's a scorching hot Saturday at the Grahamsville Little World's Fair. And it's here where we meet all kinds of people that make the region's agriculture so special. It's where Barbara Moran and I head down a hill to a small barn.
So we're walking over by our dairy tent. Now, goats, if you don't know, are dairy goats and meat goats. So we have two different kinds, but we also have a lot of pet goats here. And goats are so much fun. Later this afternoon, we're going to be having our goat obstacle course, where you'll watch the kids lead them through an array of obstacles. So welcome to our goat tent.
That's Barbara Moran. She's a 4-H program manager at Sullivan County's Cornell Cooperative Extension.
4-H is the largest youth program in the nation. It encompasses four pillars. So we talk about agriculture, civic engagement, STEM, and healthy living. And within that, there are thousands of lessons that come to the children. So when we talk about 4-H, we talk about a 4-H club. Children can also be independent members. And then we push into schools with in-school and after-school programs.
Well, big thanks to Kimberly Izar for coming on to talk to us and for going to the Grahamsville Little World's Fair to report on it. To hear the rest of her report, well, you got to be listening to Farm and Country Saturday morning at 10. But for now, I'll let you know that's it for the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. I'll be back here with you again tomorrow. We'll talk to Philip Pantuso of the Times Union. And keep listening, because coming up, we've got the Retro Cocktail Hour at 7. But before that, it's more news from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
WJFF.